Coming up on this episode.
And had it not been for the U.S. Navy, I'm sure that the war, regional war, would have been. So the U.S. Navy, largest aircraft carriers, is parked outside of the coast of Lebanon, or mess with Hezbollah. You also mess with Iran. And that's why they're always so much more worried about them, because you're facing a state that has huge capabilities. But what Hamas is really good at is financing. That the three top Hamas leaders who are living in Qatar, etc., they are worth around $10 billion.
That's an extraordinary wealth.
That's extraordinary wealth. And
how?
So they do it through multiple ways, but they would have fighters go and lie in their graves so they can feel how what it feels like.
That's powerful.
And then in these group dynamics, they would also videotape them giving their last testimony. So if you videotape someone, then you can't really back out,
totally,
right?
Totally. Yeah. Oh my God.
So when you entered into ISIS territory, you had to fill in a form of 23 questions, and it was like, it's like a control form of who you are, who are your parents, what's your home address, who got you in contact with ISIS, why did you come, what route did you take, etc. So they, so every single ISIS recruit has one of those files. While they were being interviewed, also to check that there are no spies, they also identify people who could potentially also be reinserted back into Europe.
What is the scariest terror group you've ever studied?
ISIS.
Why?
They are so brutal, beheading. This sort of complete lack of any boundaries, even when you kill.
That was Dr. Magnus Ranstorp. He's a Swedish academic, hostage negotiator, teacher, and author who has been researching and writing about terrorism for more than 30 years. He is an encyclopedia on modern terrorism and political violence. He was also the very first author to seriously map out the Lebanese Hezbollah and its connections to Iran, Syria, and international terrorism. And so before we get into the show, I just want to remind you, direct message to you, my dear Geopolitics and Power podcast listener. This show that you're listening to right now, for which I'm talking directly to you, is an afterthought. My primary show is called A Curious Worldview, where it's the exact same style of interviewing, of production, and everything else, but it is a further extension of my interests. So there are lots of guests who appear on there that would never make it into this feed. For instance, Russ Roberts, the host of Econ Talk, just to pick one off the top of the head. So let's assume you and I have more interests in common than just whatever lands on this feed here. It's the top link in this podcast description. Go over there, subscribe, give it 5 stars, and let me know that you signed up. But back to Dr. Magnus Ranstorp. So there are timestamps here to help you navigate through, but settle in from beginning to end, because Magnus is a compelling communicator on these topics. We cover much more than just Hamas and religious terrorists. There is Norway's most horrific terror attack, Anders Breivik. Magnus talks about how Sweden has become the number one European enemy of the Islamic world. Magnus reflects on his career, serendipity, so much more. So, subscribe to Curious Worldview. And now, sit back, because with absolutely no further ado, here is Magnus Ranstorp.
All right, Magnus, how has terrorism changed over the course of your lifetime?
Well, I was born in the 1960s, and of course, there were different issues. In the 1960s, you had Palestinian groups, that whole alphabet soup that was around. You had different factions uniting under the umbrella of the PLO. You had the Six-Day War, of course, that propelled some of them to undertake action. And then there was a massive explosion of hijackings during that period. And in fact, it coincided also with the Vietnam War, and the Vietnam War and the student protest movements, the New Left, really created the perfect storm for a whole generation. In fact, it is still impacting us today when it comes to the legacy of this, and it's coming back actually now to sort of reverberate when it comes to the Israeli-Hamas conflict. It's the same kind of forces that are coming back that was present in the 1970s. During that period too, the Palestinians wanted to internationalize their cause, and they tried different methods. They saw also, of course, that the sort of French colonial control over Algeria had become successful in sort of trying to wrest off the French rule, and so therefore they took to hijacking, and there was a spate of hijackings occurring in the late 1960s, early 70s. It also coincided with the fact that you had satellite TV or sort of TV was developing. So you had a combination of new communication, you know, traveling around the world through planes became easier. The media became worldwide, more global. And those coincided with causes like the Palestinian cause that sort of married itself to left-wing causes and the student movement and the protest and the revolt around among the young generation, which also meant that you had uprisings in Europe. For example, the Baader-Meinhof gang and the Rote Armee-Fraktion and the other left-wing groups that saw in the Palestinian cause, David and Goliath cause, where it was very clear who was the colonializer, who was the oppressed, who had the power, who was the victim. And in fact, what happened during that period was also that these Palestinian groups, etc., they were supported by these left-wing terrorist groups in Europe, the Red Army faction and the Red Brigades in Italy, the fighting communist cells in Belgium. They all came together, and in fact, some of those Red Army factions, for example, participated in Palestinian training camps in the Middle East. It's just like in the movies. There have been movies that have shown this. For example, when groups are training in Libya, you had the IRA, you had the other groups that were all coming together. So you had like a real perfect storm, ideological perfect storm, etc. But let me add one level of complexity. It was also within the realm of the Cold War. The Cold War competition between the United States and Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc, the Warsaw Pact. And many of the Russians claim that they were the one inventing the hijacking instrument to as a pressure point. So they funded Palestinian groups. They trained Red Army faction people as well in East Germany with Stasi. But also there was a university, Patrice Lumumba University in Moscow, that where you had revolutionaries going, Palestinians, you had other people going there. And so they sort of used terrorism also. Was not done just by ideological causes, left-wing causes, etc., or Palestinian causes, but they were also sponsored by the Soviet Union. It was part of a battle, a hybrid warfare by the Soviets against the West, and that has continued to this day. But of course, terrorism changed over time, so you had Palestinian groups, they also used terrorism to get, for example, the PLO and Palestinian factions used terrorism. In the Munich Olympic Games, they received observer status at the UN because of terrorism. There was a spate of hijackings, etc. But then, of course, the West woke up and said, look, you know, we have to do something about this. So they developed X-ray machines. And the X-ray machines then meant that the terrorists had to be more innovative. And that gradually, over time, led to terrorists using plastic explosives and trying to smuggle in different types of weapons on board through ingenious ways. So in all of this, right? So you have in the 1980s, terrorism becomes also more lethal. Why? Because we arrest the first generation of leaders who are more ideologically prone. The second generation in the 1980s becomes more bloody. They have more indiscriminate attacks, like the Abu Nidal group. They undertook Palestinian group. They undertook very deadly operations against airports, where they threw hand grenades. They shot the passengers down, etc. And then, of course, you had the end of the Cold War, and the end of the Cold War also meant that some of those groups died. Right? They died ideologically. They died slowly, and we had a new era, and that was sort of one strand of a multi-strand development. On top of that, you had an earthquake moment in 1979 with the Iranian Revolution, where the Shah of Iran was overturned, and it showed that the impossible was possible. The Shia revolution in Iran also meant that Iran needed to export its revolution. So they began to export Shia groups in the Gulf, but also its biggest prize was in Lebanon with Hezbollah. And then began a wave of religious motivated terrorism with Islamism.
It wasn't religious motivated before?
It was there were religiously motivated actors before, but most of the Palestinian actors, they were Marxist-Leninists, you know. They were, you know, secular, and therefore
political radicals rather than Islamic radicals.
Political radicals, etc. And while they were hijacking away in Europe, then of course you had another development sneaking quietly that has implications today. The Muslim Brotherhood expanded their activities in the Middle East. And particularly it had an impact because it came to Gaza and to the West Bank and so on. So they began developing social structures for the Muslim Brotherhood that grew into what would later become Hamas. And Hamas is operating on all these different levels, on the social level, on the political and religious level. But, you know, it took until 1987 when they were founded to become what they are today. And they call themselves, of course, the Arabic acronym for the Islamic Resistance Movement.
This is Hamas?
This is Hamas, the Mukawama. Resistance happens on all fronts, and they are mutually reinforcing. So if you strike at Israel, Israel will strike back. And then, of course, Hamas can move in with social services and take all the sort of people who have been affected by it, and then they can convert that into supporters. And they began acting when we had the Israeli-Palestinian peace process in the early 1990s with the so-called Oslo Accord. And that's when they began acting, because they wanted to sabotage any peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians. I'm not sure that Israel was really, they were prepared to make concessions, etc. But after Hamas began acting, and after they assassinated, there also was a Jewish extremist assassination of the architect Yitzhak Rabin. The whole peace process sort of died a slow death. And the Israelis started to create facts on the ground to, you know, that you can negotiate with in the trade. And Hamas, of course, in this sort of situation, only entrenched themselves even deeper into this. It's complicated to explain all of these things because someone once told me, a senior person who worked within, he was a senior MI6 head. He said at a conference I attended that trying to understand sort of politics in the Middle East is extraordinarily complicated. It's like playing three-dimensional chess underwater with all the pieces moving simultaneously. So if you don't understand the macro or the meso or the micro, and there are multiple games being played at the same time, you're not going to be able to handle all of the things. It's like life in general, right?
Could you speak more to the nature of the change? I thought you said something really interesting there, commenting how once the X-ray was brought in, the terrorism became more bloody because they had to be more innovative about the weaponry they brought in. So in your career since the 60s, well, born in the 60s, but at least maybe the 80s when you're really working on this, how has it changed?
Well, I became interested in this really in the 1970s, 1979 with the Iranian Revolution, etc. And it has changed in relation to, it takes different leaps in relation to technology, in relation to countermeasures that is being done. So you had the X-ray for trying to foil hijackings, etc. Then the terrorists moved to plastic explosives and trying to circumvent, trying to be ingenious about how do they smuggle on board these things. Of course, we saw the consequences of not, you know, failure of imagination, of not having even thought through that you can use an aircraft as an implosion weapon. So you can actually sort of crash them into buildings, and then, you know, you have multiple effects. And also, if you have a camera, you can film it, right? So if you have two crashes into the World Trade Center, you will make sure that at least one of them will be filmed, and the, you know, the aftermath and so on. So it's also creating the shock effect. One of the largest, you know, following 9/11, one of the biggest terror events that we foiled, or luckily we foiled, was the so-called liquid bomb plot that was in 2006, which really involved the terrorists had trying to circumvent airport security, and they realized that they can use liquid explosive. And they used energy drinks, and they could inject liquid explosives into them so that, and then you can seal them. But you can actually build the bombs behind. You can smuggle in the different parts, and then you can build the bomb behind the airport security measures. And the plan was to, you had a vast amount of hijackers who were radicalized. They were going to board aircraft at Heathrow and heading for North America. 7-8 aircraft were going to take off with 2-hour intervals towards the U.S. Once the first ones reached the U.S. shores or North America or Canada, they were also going to Canada, they would start exploding. So we would have sort of almost like a synchronized explosion. When the last plane had taken off from Heathrow, you would have 7 planes that would have been blown up in the air. You can also see how they tried to innovate and improvise. You had Richard Reed, the shoe bomber. Very easy construction, but they tried to ignite his shoe, a bomb that was there. You had the underwear bomber, to concealment in the underwear. So you have all these sort of different ways. So the airport security is always trying, is always playing catch up. You know, what can they use? Can you use drones as an attack vehicle, airborne attack? They realized that when Angela Merkel was doing a political rally and some of her, this was not a terrorist attack, but someone had sent up a drone which circumvented the security, and all of a sudden that came onto the radar. You know, you can actually use drones both to film but also to attack from the air. So you have to think through all these sort of different technologies, and that has sort of exploded. It's just, you know, you have to then start to think about how can we find ways to intercept terrorist innovation. How do they learn? How do they learn during their operational planning? And they're very, you know, for example, in Gaza and so on, they are, most of the rockets that they make are made from, you know, water pipes, but also through experimentation and also how you make explosives. And when you live under very tight sort of tight conditions where you don't have a lot of things, the same thing with IEDs in Iraq, improvised explosive devices, becoming, you know, being good at engineering, being good at sort of experimenting through different, you
turning
know,
scraps into a weapon.
Turning scraps into a weapon. You will then become very proficient. And the thing is to sort of try to find, and this is what the US have done in many different theaters, is to find the bomb designer. Not the one who delivers the bomb, but the one who designed the bomb. And Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula was particularly, had one particular person who was making the sort of, you know, the printer cartridge bombs. You had the underwear bombings, etc. You had planning, very clever people who were planning, how do we circumvent security and so on. So there's a constant cat and mouse. This kind of innovation also happens on communication when it comes to how do they communicate without being intercepted. In 9/11, they were very clever because they what they had done was that they, in order to communicate back to Afghanistan and to other places where, you know, internet was beginning to come. We didn't have really sort of social media to that extent, but how do you send an email without being detected? And what they discovered was that they wrote if you and I were going to communicate, we establish an email address and then we write in draft and we never send it. So you know, you can go in and you can start editing, and I can start editing, and that's how they didn't send some of the emails. That means that if you or NSA or GCHQ or other, you will have to go in and break into the servers and to really sort of find. So that's what they did after 9/11, you know, the internet cafes in Pakistan or in Afghanistan, etc., to try to see, okay, where are they sending these things? The same thing with if you use encryption, they can break encryption. Some of the encryption, but you have to be able to do that in real time, and that's even becoming more challenging because you have so many different platforms, and you may even have sort of self-standing servers and other things. So that is a real sort of problem. Now you may have new technology. So how is AI going to impact today this sort of sphere? You can for example, use AI to ask AI, you know, what's the most vulnerable way in which I were to attack a particular target? And AI will answer, we'll scroll through. Or you can use self-driving cars, and you can, in the future maybe, when this become more, you know, you can just place a bomb on a self-driving car, etc. You can also do all sorts of things. So what the intelligence community and what others are doing is that they are really sort of brainstorming what are all possible ways in which we can try to do this. And they also test airport security. They test to see if it can be detected. And I think that's quite an interesting. Yeah.
Regarding all this, what's the most creative thing you've ever come across?
I think it's pretty creative to when you're going to do such a big operation, you don't go sort of super high tech, you go low tech, and then like 9/11 attacks, but you know you find all sorts of different ways in which surprises you. Now, one of the things that really surprised me was how Hamas did this operation against the Israelis on the 7th of October, 2023.
What did they do?
well, it was such a large-scale operation. It required, actually, it wasn't their operation originally. It was an operation by the Lebanese Hezbollah in Lebanon. 10 years ago, it was leaked that they had a plan to storm across the border. And when I say storm, through tunnels. They had built tunnels underneath, northern Israel, South Lebanon. And they, even 10 kilometers in, and they were going to storm, once they emerged from the tunnels, northern villages and towns, and they were going to also attack from the sea with 5,000 men, not the 3,000 that Hamas used, but 5,000. And they were going to kidnap people back to Lebanon, and they were going to kill as many as possible. So this what Hamas did was not their own thinking, right? It was out there in the open. And what Israel has been doing ever since then has been to try to shut down the tunnels, because they're more scared of Hezbollah than they are of Hamas. Hamas, they got pegged, because Hamas is not going anywhere. They have control over the Palestinians, or at least they thought they had. And they rely too much on static technology. Most of the forces, IDF forces in the south, had relocated to West Bank because it seemed to be more trouble there. It was a holiday. It was an anniversary of the Yom Kippur War. And what they did was they used drones with bombs to knock out the communication facility so that the IDF could not communicate locally. And then they broke through. They attacked the sentry towers and the towers. And before the Israelis could mobilize, you had people streaming across. And what I didn't realize from the beginning was that this was all across the... When you look at a map, exactly where people died or where they were kidnapped, etc., it stretches in the north all the way down 40 kilometers, because the Gaza Strip is 40 kilometers long, 10 to 16 kilometers wide at its widest. And you had 3,000 armed or 2,500, 3,000 armed factions or individuals within these factions, who were just there to massacre people, and they to actually do this kind of big operation requires coordination. And I'm still convinced, even though everyone denies it. The more you deny it, the more it looks suspicious, right? So Hezbollah is denying every single speech. They're denying. Why? Because they don't want to give the Israelis...
But what are they denying?
They're denying that they were involved. This was an entire Palestinian operation. Yeah. So they don't want to give. And had it not been for the U.S. Navy, I'm sure that the regional war would have been... So the U.S. Navy, largest aircraft carriers, is parked outside of the coast of Lebanon. You got the British, you know, naval... And they even submitted... A U.S. U-boat, a submarine, which carries ballistic missiles, can also carry nuclear weapons. That's a signal to the Iranians. Do not, because Iran is also behind all of this. They provide support both to Hamas but also to Hezbollah. So Hamas is quite a sort of... a complex organization, in that you have different committees. You have a Politburo composed of 15 people, and the highest person on the Politburo is Ismail Haniyeh. I happened to meet Ismail Haniyeh in 1998 when he became the assistant to the spiritual leader of Hamas, Sheikh Yassin.
Nice guy.
He was a nice guy. I'd never heard of him, actually. He was quite sort of, I mean, he was known, but he was not so visible, but he would become visible. He would become the leader of Hamas. He would become the he won the election for in 2005, 2006, and he has been the leader. Still, the most powerful person, very well groomed member, but he was helping the paraplegic Sheikh Yassin, who stark contrast. You know, he's sitting in his wheelchair. He's helping him, so you have this sort of board of the Politburo. You have also a council that is composed of all the disparate parts of Hamas, and then you have the military wing, and the military wing has around 30,000, 40,000 members. But the important thing is when you look at the council that makes all the sort of decision, they are elected from different parts of Hamas. So you have a Gaza leadership, and the Gaza leadership, it controls, of course, all of the Gaza Strip and the territory. And you have Hamas in the West Bank. You have representation from Hamas in prison. You also have representation from Hamas in the external leadership. You also have representation of Hamas in the diaspora, in other places. And all, so it's like a collective decision-making. Now, the highest leaders of Hamas, the ones, the Politburo, the ones who've been there a long time, who've been on the outside a long time, is based in Qatar. They have been doing a little bit of a traveling circus. They also have connections to Turkey. In fact, they travel back and forth between Qatar and Turkey. Some of the leadership was previously based in Jordan. And I have a funny story with one of the Jordanians. If you want me to tell you, I'll tell you that story.
Yeah, we'll embrace the humor.
Well, we have to, because it's such a sort of
it's grim stuff.
It's a grim stuff, and I once met with one of the Hamas leaders called Mohammed Nazal. And Mohammed Nazal, you have to understand that, you know, on the outside leadership, they and this is in the late 1990s when I met them, but also they've been continuing like this, is that the ones who take the military decisions, they're based on the outside, so that the Israelis can't touch them. Right, so they can't come and assassinate them. They do sometimes try it, but and so I'm sitting. I actually have been asking Ismail Haniyeh for how do I get in touch with external leadership, etc. And then he doesn't really want to give me any phone numbers, but he gives me clues where I should look, and I find them, and I find all the numbers, and so I show up, and in the meeting, I come into this meeting, the person is mean-looking. And in the outer office, there are machine guns. I mean, the people guarding him. And as I'm sitting talking to him, and, you know, we don't talk about any operationals. You can never, they will never say anything. So we talk about, you know, what do they want? Can they see any peace process? Where do they come from, etc.? You have to dance around the fire. So I'm dancing around the fire, and this guy comes in with, his helper comes in with small pieces of paper, which he unfolds. And he, you know, he's talking to me, he reads it, and then he shreds it. Right? And I'm thinking, okay, he's coming in with operational sort of, I'm so close to the fire now. But then all of a sudden he says to me, Magnus, he didn't say Magnus, but he said, you know, you have to understand that the local units in Hebron came with an idea of an operation, and he has to prove it. So he asked them, what kind of operation do you have in mind? And he said, well, we want to kidnap an Israeli politician, was then the message relayed back. And his answer was, probably not in the way I'm relaying it now, but it was basically, don't be ridiculous. Have you seen the size of that man? It would be logistically possible. And the person that they had suggested was Ariel Sharon. And for those of you who don't know who Ariel Sharon is, he has been very, very controversial. He doesn't live in it. He is dead. He doesn't live anymore. He was responsible for the Sabra and Shatila massacres in Lebanon, in Palestinian refugee camps, etc., and defense minister. Very, very hated figure, Likud, you know, very hard man. Now, the only time I ever met Ariel Sharon was in the Knesset, and I wasn't there to see him. I was in the Knesset, and someone said to me, "Would you like to meet Ariel Sharon?" That's what, why not? It would be great fun. It's not a big place either. So I said, "Sure," but I didn't know what to say to him. So actually, what I told him was that you are too fat to be kidnapped by Hamas. And he loved it. He loved it. He loved it. They're like chutzpah, right? Yeah, that's balls. So good. Yeah. And he loved it so much. He said, he looked at me and smiled. And you also have to understand, he has one eye pointing this way, other way. You don't know which to focus in on. And he smiles in his sort of, you know, little devilish way. And he says, "Do you think I pay for my bodyguards? They pay me. I protect. I provide a big shadow for them."
So, how big is he?
He is big. He was big. He was massive. It's almost like having two persons standing in front of you. Yeah. So that shows that even in the sort of darkest hours, there are also senses of humor. Yeah.
Since we're talking about Hamas, or since it was brought up, you mentioned in your opening comments about what the meaning of Hamas was. It was sort of like an attack on all fronts.
Yeah, so it means it's the Arabic acronym for the Islamic Resistance Movement. And that resistance takes place on the social front, because Hamas is a religious social movement. They want to re-Islamicize society, and you have to do that by it's almost like the Swedish welfare state, right? From the cradle to the grave. we will, if you martyr yourself, you will pay the family for a lifetime. You will, they reject any peace process. They want to annihilate or eradicate Israel. But they're also smart, because they can be tactical, so they can call for a truce. But they say that the Palestinian land is a waqf, it's a sacred trust, not to be given away, not to be negotiated. So they're absolutist. Mm. But what they do is they maneuver, you know, very cleverly. And what they did during the operation on the 7th of October was that they were faking that they were content with how it was, and they tried to keep quiet on the Gaza front. They prevented other groups so that the Israelis wouldn't put a lot of forces there. And also they made trouble in the West Bank so that they, you know, the forces would go there.
And the media manipulation then, it's completely intentional? This is a part of the attack on all fronts?
Well, they for 2 years they were planning this operation. And for 2 years they planned the operation, and they tried to sort of show that it is not us you should be worried about. And the really interesting thing, it worked. I was in Israel 3 weeks before the 7th of October, and I listened to, I was at a terror conference north of Tel Aviv. The head of the IDF, the defense minister, and the head of Mossad was speaking, and they all were talking about Iran, and they were all worried about Hezbollah, but Iran. Iran and Hezbollah is almost one and the same, because they support them so closely. The Iranian Revolutionary Guards support Hezbollah. They were there from its creation. It's the organization they really fear, because they have really completely different weapon system. It's like fighting Iran on your border, but through proxy. And they operate together. They do joint operations, sometimes very far away. Like in Argentina, they blew up the Israeli embassy. They blew up the Jewish Friendship Association. They operate. If you mess with Iran, you also, or mess with Hezbollah, you also mess with Iran. And that's why they're always so much more worried about them, because you're facing a state that has huge capabilities, technical capabilities, missiles, you know, in terms of smarts, you know. Whereas Hamas is, they're operating on a shoestring, right? They have nothing. They have to improvise, etc. And it's difficult. They have to rely on smuggling, so they smuggle. But what Hamas is really good at is financing, and their financial global financial institutions have been revealed over time, but they were specifically revealed. They were specifically revealed when you had U.S. Treasury starting to list individuals and list companies. And what it does reveal is that the three top Hamas leaders who are living in Qatar, etc., they are worth around $10 billion.
That's an extraordinary wealth.
That's extraordinary wealth. And
how?
So they do it through multiple ways. One way is that they when they took over Gaza from the Palestinian Authority in 2006-07, they are taxing goods that are coming in, that are being smuggled. And how do they smuggle? Well, you have the Israeli border crossing in the north, and you have Rafah in the south. And they get about 20% of 20% of the, you know, how much the goods are worth.
So, for instance, several tons of cement is brought into Gaza.
Yes.
These three men swipe 20% of what that sale value is off the top.
That's right. And yes. And also they tax other goods. They levy taxes around 20% on top of what is smuggled in tunnels. So if it's not for Hamas, they will tax you. So you have a taxation system that works. They also have to try to sort of, they don't want to try to smuggle in. You know, it's difficult to sort of transfer money. You can do that, of course, through like a hawala system where you write credit notes, etc. But what they do also is, if you want to get a lot of money in, you buy goods in Egypt, or you buy goods, you then smuggle them in, and then you sell them. And that's how they can circumvent sort of money transfer systems.
I don't understand that. Say that again.
So if you one way to sort of circumvent this is to buy something big, costly, smuggle it into Gaza. So Iran finances something. And it's bought in Egypt, etc., and then it's smuggled into Gaza, and then it's sold for cash. And then, now you have cash. You convert goods to cash. Okay. Instead of, you cannot really wire money, because that can be sort of seen, or you can, because these countries also want to conceal their involvement. Yeah. They also now use, they are very good at cryptocurrency.
Okay.
Yeah, so they are using that a lot, also with exchange houses.
And crypto's got so much blood on its hands.
Yeah.
I had on Zeke Pham 2 weeks ago. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, but he wrote a book called Number Go Up.
Yeah.
And among many other things, he documents the pig butchering in Cambodia.
Yeah.
And how all of these scams underneath so much of their infrastructure is Tether USD and then a million other coins that they convert into it.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy just how dirty the money is.
Yeah, no, but also, I mean, they also have what they call, Hamas have an investment company, and that investment company, it takes all the sort of money that's been levied. They also, of course, you get humanitarian aid. So all the humanitarian aid is under the control of Hamas, even to the UN. So they take money from that, they siphon off money. Both from
these
the
three
person,
men,
these
in
three
Qatar.
Men, but also the for the organization itself, and they have people who are controlling this investment fund, and this investment fund runs legitimate businesses in Turkey, in Sudan. They have a mining company in Sudan. They have a real estate conglomerate. They have
diversified.
They diversify the different types of investment. They have it in Algeria. They have it in other places, and they are very good at generating funding. And of course, they also have the diaspora, Palestinians living in Sweden, in Denmark, and other places who are collecting money. So they also send money, both to their relatives, but also they can be siphoned off. So they have, you know, you have this sort of discrepancy between these poor people living in these, you know, Gaza, ordinary people, poor, starving, having nothing, suffering. And you have these rich men who are living in luxury apartments in Qatar, in Turkey. They buy citizenship in Turkey as well. So it is so upsetting when you see what they are doing and the sort of wrath that they have created, of course, with the Israelis having to respond. It's really interesting. Hezbollah is even better.
Yeah. Okay.
Hezbollah is good at generating money. They are good at storing money. They are good at concealing it. They're also good at moving money, right? And if you're good at all those sort of different things, then because you know money is the oxygen of terrorism. If you don't have money, you can't do very much. And therefore, a priority issue is to try to, just like airport security, you have to try to find the new technologies. You also have to counter cryptocurrencies. You have to sort of see where you can identify how they're going to move the money, where are they going to store it, how can you hurt the organization by tackling the money. And that is a sort of also a really interesting front. So what most people don't see is that the counterterrorism chase, you have these intelligence services who are thinking of how, you know, what is happening in the organization, how do we keep ourselves safe, but more importantly, they're also chasing down leads of an organization, both physically, what is the person's doing together. They're doing it virtually through social media. You know, how are they communicating? How are they spreading propaganda, etc.? You know, because intelligence services can also do a lot of interesting, scary stuff by going into your phone, going into your house, listening into. Once they get a sort of ping on the radar, once you are in the crosshairs, they can. You know, it's pretty scary what they can. Find and cover. And then, of course, you have also on the financial front, how do you counter this? How do you find out how they fund themselves? Where are the vulnerabilities? How can you counter that? So it's a fascinating world.
A couple days after October 7th, I was watching SVT and the guest, I forget his name, but he was a member of SIDA, which is Sweden's governmental body that allocates financial aid throughout the world. And he was asked about money given to Hamas or to Palestine, not exactly sure which, mm-hmm. you know, how it was directed.
Yeah.
And they asked, how do you know it's not being spent? And he said, oh, because they promised me that they wouldn't spend it on this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I could not believe that was the official response from the government organization. Because, I mean, I'm sure you know the answer to this, but how many millions of euros has Sweden given to Hamas over the years?
I think it's difficult to say exactly how much, but it's the same thing if you give money to Syria and it's ISIS control. ISIS is going to take a big cut. You have to, you know, you cannot operate in the environment without them taking a cut. And of course, what's also been the problem with Gaza, first of all, they don't know where the money is actually going. Part of it they do, but Sweden is a huge donor, so is the United States. But it's difficult to sort of count. You have corruption, and you have corruption scandals being unearthed all the time in operating and giving money, etc. And also, you know, you're channeling money. For example, SIDA channels money to the Islamic Relief. Now, Islamic Relief organization, etc., have also connections to the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, Hamas is a part of the Muslim Brotherhood. So, you know, does it go to the population that is needing, or does it go to the organizations? You can't see it.
So to return or to wrap a bow on the money in Hamas, because I think that's so, so fascinating, because it feels like if you could somehow really restrict, you know, the income, then they have way less material to deal with to then make missiles out of, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But Gaza is a disastrous economy. It's a tiny place. I don't know what they produce. So could you break down then a pie chart of the income for these three men in Qatar with billions and billions? You mentioned 20% tax on goods that come into Gaza, but that feels like it must be marginal since the economy will be so low anyway.
Well, it's more sizable than I would think. I don't have the exact numbers with me, but when I looked at the exact sort of, you know, the economy, they are very ingenious, and they're not completely isolated from the world. The real estate there is hotels. The 2.2 million people living there, and so you have commerce.
Do we have a GDP of Palestine?
Yes, I don't have it here. Okay. I had to look it up.
Yeah.
But there is an overall GDP, and
this says 18 billion as of 2021 USD.
Yeah,
does that sound about right?
Something like that, yes. And but then, of course, you have also money being sent through remittances and so on, and you have development. Problem is that you have UNRWA, United Nations Work and Relief Agency, which is run mainly by Palestinians, etc. And the problem is that they've also been caught with educational material that shows that they are material that indoctrinates young Palestinian youth in terms of, you know, the problem is that they teach the kids how to hate Israelis because they're part of a struggle. And the problem is that you have had a radicalization since Hamas took over, and they were isolated also by the young generation because they never met anyone. If it's not a soldier, you can only work, and this is what the Israelis did beforehand when they thought that things were calm and, you know, they were pretty amenable, was that they open up for work from Palestinians who are married, who have a family. Those kind of people can get work permits, some of them, only very limited number, to work in Israel, but you can get 10 times the salary you can get from Gaza. So so I think, you know, it's gone on for such a long time. It's an intractable conflict. You cannot solve the conflict because there are so many moving parts. You have the sacredness of Jerusalem for both the Jews and the also for Christians, but we don't care so much. I mean, even, you know, I don't know if you have ever been to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
No.
There you have competition between different strands of Christianity who don't trust each other, and they fight so much amongst themselves that every night they lock up the church where Jesus was crucified and resurrected. And they give the person, the keeper, is Muslim family who has done this for centuries.
Oh, wow.
For several times. So, but you have that, you have all the, you know, it's really interesting because UNRWA are classifying also descendants of Palestinians through generations who are descendants of those that, you know, may want to return one day. So the number of people living on the outside who never can come back, the diaspora, you know, some of them keep their keys to the houses when, you know, after the Israeli-Arab wars, in order to hope that they return. There's a dream that they return, the right of return. But there are so many who are living on in Jordan, in Lebanon, in other places, that it's completely inconceivable for Israel. It would be a suicide for Israel to let back all these people. And in the meantime, of course, they have to, it's a small country, Israel is a very small country. So you have the West Bank, and then there you have the Palestinian Authority and the Fatah and the other factions, etc. You also have Hamas there, but they hide themselves more. It's such a complicated conflict. And of course, the Israelis also have settlers who are building settlements. They have increased those settlements, I think, 450% since they began the peace process, etc. So I mean, I actually met the, you know, in 1992, 1993, you had the Oslo process, right? They came together under Yitzhak Rabin, and they negotiated Gaza, Jericho first. So let's sort of relinquish that to the Palestinian Authority, and they can govern that, and also the town of Jericho, which is sitting in the sort of Jordan Valley. And they did that, and then they said, okay, phase two, we're going to do Oslo two, so that would be the West Bank, and then they had different security arrangements there, etc. But as soon as I began doing all of this, Hamas began doing suicide operations and attacks to sabotage the peace process. And that now has gone on for 30 years, and there is nothing left. And you also have a corrupt Fatah Palestinian leadership. Mahmoud Abbas... he doesn't have many years left of him, and he hasn't held any elections. It's a corrupt elite, doesn't have any credibility with the population. What do you do? How do you get new leaders? And how do you get people who do not want to fight, who do not want to sort of do resistance? And so I don't see a way out of this. I sometimes listen to people on TV, and they talk about, well, we got to have peace process and peace, and there is no conditions for it. And it's even become completely intractable with what happened after the 7th of October. Plus, in Israel, we never had a worse, when I say we, in other words, the West, in terms of its relationship with Israel, we've never had a worse government. We have a religious government. We have Netanyahu. We have settlements. We have religious settlers and religious extremists who are trying to become maximalist on their side. They want to create a Jewish state on behalf, on top of the Palestinian one. So I can't see how it's going to be solved. So we're going to have conflict there.
In perpetuity.
In perpetuity. And then on top of that, you got these guys in Lebanon, Hezbollah, the Shia, they are the proxies of Iran. They have missiles going after Israel. You have the Iranians who want to destroy Israel. And of course, we had some hope before, because you then saw that there's been normalization through the Abraham Accords. You've had normalization with the UAE, and now we're going to, maybe have it with Saudi Arabia. And that was all scuttled with this attack. So you then have to sort of understand that maybe Iran is behind it, maybe Hamas wanted to do a regional war. They want the West Bank to rise up. They want Hezbollah to get involved. And everyone's sort of waiting now. It's sort of wait and see. They're in a holding pattern to see what is going to happen. How worse can it get? And of course, it's storming in the West, in Europe, on campuses in the United States, in the Western capitals. You have Israeli-Palestinian protests. You have massive amounts of anti-Semitism. You have massive amounts.
So surprising, eh?
Well, I wasn't surprised.
Really?
No, I wasn't. Well, I wasn't surprised that it existed underneath. But how do you turn this back into the bottle? And the Jewish community. The Jewish faith community, synagogues, etc., has already a massive terrorist threat against them. And this is from Al-Qaeda, from ISIS, from others. On top of that, now you also have this issue where they're going after individual Jews. They are going after them in their homes. They're going after ordinary people who have nothing to do with the conflict. And you got a riled up Palestinian community together with left-wing extremists. You have a younger generation who doesn't understand anything about the conflict. I don't know if you've seen this. There was a funny film done. I don't know who did the film, but it said, look, you know, will you, I think it was in the US, will you sign this appeal for peace in, for supporting Hamas and peace in Palestine, right? And most of the people that they met, they said, yes, of course. But before you sign, let me read the conditions, right? And then it says, would you agree to throw homosexuals off the rooftops? Would you agree to a Sharia state? Would you agree to women being veiled and, having all the rights and freedoms that we have? And of course, they wouldn't sign it. No. But they don't understand the conflict. And yet, what they can understand is that this is a David Goliath fight, that Israel is a militarily more superior actor, and of course they want to support the underdog, the Palestinians, because they're suffering through the population, etc. And what Israel, I mean I myself has been involved with trying to help in a hostage exchange operation between Hezbollah and Israel. There were three soldiers and a businessman taken captive. I was the extended arm of a UN negotiator who sent me in because he wanted to be under the radar, or the mission was to be under the radar. We made contact. We had some contact. We weren't successful. There were others who took over the process. But there were three soldiers and one business person, Israeli Jewish. The Hamas now has 200 plus hostages. And previously, Israel has done massive asymmetric hostage deal. They have exchanged one soldier for 1,400 prisoners, wow. Palestinian prisoners. In fact, the last time there was a big hostage exchange was when one soldier was kidnapped in around 2006-07, he was held for a long time and then negotiated a deal that released 1,200-300 people. And one person who was part of that deal is the head of Hamas in Gaza now, Yahya Sinwar. So you can then imagine the trauma for the Israelis who never leave any soldiers behind enemy lines, who allow for making these asymmetric hostage deals just to get back one of these people. Yeah. Then you understand what a shock it is for Israel, because they never ever had such a big operation against them. They always, when in the past, Hamas would do a suicide operation. It maybe can do a double or triple. In other words, there would be two or three people who would position themselves somewhere, and then they would pull the cord, so they would explode themselves, and then maybe 60 people would die. What the Israelis would do then would be first of all, retrieve all the body parts of those who were died to bury them. But there's a special unit in Israel who does that. But also, they would find the identity of the person, and then they would go to their family, and then they would use a bulldozer to take down the whole house. Right? It's like, I will crush you if you touch any of our citizens, etc. It's a massive retaliation against the entire family as a deterrence. But now Israel has lost its deterrence, right? It's, so many people. And the level of insecurity is huge in Israel. And the sad part is that most of the people who were living in this kibbutz, they were actually, you know, more liberal, more peace-orientated. They even employed workers from Gaza that, and they would pay them much more than they would be inside. And so this trauma, I think, is going to take a long time for the Israelis to get over as a nation.
I don't know if you would ever get over it.
No. And I'll show you one thing just to, I don't know if you've seen this. I'm going to show you. There is this map that was done. Let's see here. I'm going to see if I can find it. There we go. This is October 7 map. And you can zoom in. And when you see the entire, you see these red dots here, is where every single person died.
Wow.
1,200, 1,400.
So it's a map which pretty much shadows the entire Palestine and Israel border. Well,
Gaza, yes. With the Gaza Strip, every single. So it's from the north to the south. So I thought initially that it was just the area around the festival ground and maybe just a few sort of kibbutz around that, but it's actually from north to south. So when you zoom in on this, you know, where the music festival, that's where the music festival was, right? So when you zoom in on that, right, you see how many people that,
Wow. Right?
And when you actually see the individual names and the individual dots and you see where they died and where they were kidnapped, you understand the scale and scope of
right,
this.
Right.
Because it's so, you know, during 9/11, 3,000 people died in the towers, right? And this is half of that. So from a small country like Israel.
Yeah, I've heard if it was taken relatively to the size of the U.S., it'd be something like 120,000 people.
Yeah.
Murdered,
yeah.
Or something like that.
And
is this the most devastating terrorist attack on record?
Besides 9/11, yes. In 2008, the security services were warning there was a terrorist attack in Mumbai, and that was for 3 days. 10 people were inserted from Pakistan, and they'd never been to India before. And when they did the operation, they had GPS locators which they followed. But when they broke into the Taj Mahal hotel, a very luxury hotel, etc., and they were massacring foreign guests, they were looking for foreigners. They were stunned by when they came into some of the rooms, both the luxury of it, etc. So there's actually recordings of them, these militant, you know, Pakistani terrorists going in to massacre people, but they get so stunned when they come into the room and they look around and say, wow, this is all luxury. And they sort of, and you can hear intercepts egging them on. There's a wonderful movie that shows
Hotel Mumbai.
Yes. Which shows the generosity of the ones who were working in the hotel, that they would not leave the hotel. They would not leave the hotel while their guests were under attack, which is amazing, beautiful movie about what happened during that day.
Yeah. To move us away from Hamas, Israel, Palestine, you mentioned before the liquid bombing, which was halted in 2006. I was wondering whether you have on top of your head a few, or just whether you have offhand a couple of other like 9/11 scale terror plots that have been stopped by law enforcement. And if you could as well just give a broader picture for how effective or non-effective law enforcement has been at bringing down the amount of potential terror attacks that have been attempted?
There was the, of course, the deadliest attack, but you want failed.
Failed.
Okay, or foiled.
And naturally, I'm sure a lot of that is under wraps, but just things that, you know, leak through to your desk.
After the Mumbai attack in 2008, which was a very, very deadly attack, the person who had done the reconnaissance...
Okay, to finish this interview with Magnus Ranstorp, it's the top link in this description. It'll take you over to A Curious Worldview podcast, my primary podcast. I just asked him about the biggest terror plots that were foiled. What you can expect after is how Sweden has been caught in the fundamentalist Islam crosshairs, Hamas gaining popularity throughout the world. Magnus takes us on a tour of Gaza. He reflects on his own memoirs. He goes deep into Anders Breivik, the difference between political and religious radicalization. He comments on the most effective propaganda he's ever seen, the most horrific terror organization he'd ever studied. There is so much left in this one. So please, top link in the description. It'll take you directly to the podcast where I really want your attention. Listen to the rest of the episode there. Pump your good juice into the algorithm. Goes without saying. And this might be the last you hear from me this year, which means Merry Christmas, and I'll be nipping at your heels 2024.